Okay, hi everybody. So hopefully I don't have to convince you that the world is facing a climate catastrophe. It's such that it spawned a mass movement all around the world of people to, not just win some environmental reform, but to save our entire species, which is a pretty ludicrous situation if you think about it, that some of us have to launch a mass movement against others of our own species to prevent our collective extinction. It's going to be hard for any campaign to top that. If we're all extinct, we won't be able to, but it's a fairly ludicrous situation. And I guess it's very pressing what are the solutions to this crisis that we're facing. And for socialists, we want to make an argument that Marxism has something to offer people who are whose ideas are thrown into turmoil by the scale of the crisis facing us. And we're sort of starting from a bit behind, because the general perception is of Marx is not of primarily an ecological thinker. And that's not purely because of anything Marx and Engels, his collaborator, themselves have done, but as much things that have happened in their name since their death. So the most obvious one being the association of Marx and Engels with the various Stalinist regimes in Russia and in China, and the appalling environmental record of those regimes that, make people think, well, if that's what socialism is all about, that's not really environmentally, doesn't have much to offer people who are concerned about the future of the planet. In addition to that, a very popular strand of Marxism, especially mainly in the West, as is connoted by the title, the School of Western Marxism, has made a founding premise of that ideological current is that Marxism and a dialectical materialist approach to understanding phenomenon around us doesn't apply to the natural world. So drawing on remarks made by Lukács and subsequently revised by Lukács, that's a critique of Engels' contention that Marxism can there's a dialectic of nature basically, and so they popularise the idea that Marxism is purely a theory of human society that does not translate into or apply to the natural world. It's a theory born out of human society and the tensions within it, and it's a theory that can therefore only explain a human society. The other, I guess, not really linked to any real phenomenon idea that Marxism doesn't have much to offer people concerned about ecology is the image, and partly to do with the times, of what was popular in the 19th century when Marx was writing, of that Marx was a productivist, that he prioritised the development of industry as a necessary precondition for human freedom, therefore at whatever cost that might come to the environment and the planet was an acceptable cost. And that, Marx, like other modernist thinkers, championed the idea that we can defeat nature through the technical abilities of society and industry, and that while, you need a critique of capitalism, the advances supposedly in industry that it created, the way that it could subdue nature, is one of its strengths and a necessary condition for a socialist society. So those things sort of kind of contribute to the idea that Marxism is not the first and foremost kind of theory that is relevant to environmental movements. More recently, I think that that's a wrong perception of Marxism, and there's been quite a lot of work done in the last 20 years or so to try and push back against that general image, done by people like Andreas Malm, if people have read anything of his, John Bellamy Foster, Paul Burkett, who are both rediscovering the kind of actual legacy of Marx and Engels, but also trying to apply that to some of the new problems that are facing humanity. And the there's plenty of quotes that they can draw on that, an important starting point for Marx and Engels was that, human beings are first and foremost a product of the natural world. I'm not going to read long quotes and bore everybody. You can look them up yourself. So in their ruthless critique of everything, that was what Marx and the guiding principle of Marx and Engels, going to argue that they did bring a revolutionary perspective to the question of how human society interacts with nature. So in their lifetime, they read voraciously all the kind of science of their times, thermodynamics, Darwin's work on evolution, the, you know, major geological discoveries that was changing people's understanding of how old the human species is was taking place around them, and they demonstrated a keen interest in all of these questions. But one of the key, I think, issues that they took up and studied and saw as important was the question of soil chemistry, and in particular the writings of Liebig, whose name hasn't survived as much of a household one as Marx and Engels, but who was a very important person at the time. And it sounds a bit prosaic, you know, for soil chemistry to us. It sort of sounds like the 19th century equivalent of, Gardening Australia or something like that. That was the kind of sum total of the interest. But actually, it was the key environmental question of the time. And, on the one hand, in the 19th century, there weren't, in comparison to today, all these huge pressing environmental questions. There wasn't the kind of sense that human society is doomed through its own, because of its own activities. But on the other hand, there was more of a keen appreciation of how capitalism and the triumph of capitalism over previous forms of class society was so radically transforming people's relationship to the environment, because there was still some memory or understanding of how people had lived before, mostly in feudal societies. There was still a lot of connection. A lot of the human population was still peasants and still had more of a direct connection to land. And so, in a way, the sensibility amongst intellectuals at the time was to be more questioning of the capitalist system, whereas today there's much more of a sense that technology is triumphant, that we're not subject to the whims of nature, that everything's just a matter, it's not just a matter of time before we find a cure for cancer or this and that, that we, we have triumphed over nature. That sort of wasn't, there wasn't that sort of confidence in what capitalism had to offer at the time. And one of the first things that highlighted that the potentially problematic relationship between capitalist society and human beings was the question of the transformation of agriculture. And so Liebig's writing was considered highly subversive at the time. It wasn't purely a scientific endeavour. In fact, the main target of his criticism was the place where agriculture was most developed in England, was his attack on the early capitalists, I don't know if you really call them capitalists, but the people that treated farming, agriculture, as trying to move it in a kind of mass direction. And his ideas were considered so subversive that his book, about, his big book about soil chemistry with a long introduction that was a political attack on English agricultural methods, was not only not published, not allowed to be published in England, but when it was sent to the English publisher, they were so concerned about it, they burnt it, because it was seen as so, just adding to CO2 levels. They burnt it because they didn't even want to have it in their possession, because it was such a fundamental attack on the powers that be in English society. And it wasn't actually published for some decades after, and even then it was published with a different title and without the introduction that attacked the English agricultural methods. So this wasn't just some sort of esoteric question. This was a key environmental question at the time, and I think it can be seen as a metaphor, really, for understanding how capitalism changes people's relationship with the environment around them. So, the argument is that whereas previous societies there was much more of a understanding of the importance of the complementary nature of humans when it comes to their food source, their source of life, the natural world around them. So for thousands of years, people have been able to survive because they've done things to ensure that the food that they rely on and the wood and stone and all of that is replenished, and they have enough of the societies that have survived have had a sufficient understanding of what they need to do to maintain that. And primarily, you know, one of the things is not having settled agriculture and, you know, using up soil, you know, depriving it of all its nutrients, taking no measures to ensure that it can regenerate by replanting crops that won't be, you know, cut down each year, and that way the soil building up its fertility again, and then for some stage humans can come back to it and use it again. Now, if you don't do that, you deplete soil of its nutrients, it drains away, it pollutes other, pollutes waterways, and it no longer becomes a source of fertile ground to grow food, and etc. And this was happening, English agriculture was happening on such a big scale that it created a kind of domino effect of other environmental problems. So because British agriculture was about depleting the soil and getting as much out of it as quickly possible time and coming back and back to it, they, rather than leave the soil to regenerate naturally, as people have done for many thousands of years, they were bringing in fertiliser from other places. And, you know, that had a disastrous environmental effect on the places that they were taking these nutrients from, and it was an unsustainable practice because, you know, they weren't taking due care to the soil, and all this would drain away after one season, and eventually they ran out of places that they could source fertilizer from around the world, leading to an environmental and economic crisis for British agriculture. And so this was, you know, I guess the kind of first example of the what is a catchphrase in Marxist ecology, a metabolic rift, a breakdown between the you know, practices of human society that ensure some balance with the natural world and ensure the ongoing survival of human society. And this can be a metaphor, I think, applied to all sorts of other areas of human endeavour, other environmental problems. So to generalise, I guess, what are some of the features then? What makes capitalism a society that, in every area that its logic is applied, creates a rift between humans and the planet that we live on? And I think what's different about capitalism is that the nature of capital itself. So capital is not rooted in anything material in the natural world necessarily. Under feudalism, you know, wealth was measured, wealth was primarily constituted by land. And so in order for the feudal lords to maintain any sort of wealth, they needed productive land that was of value to them, that peasants could work to produce produce wealth. And that meant that created a fairly strong incentive for feudal rulers to maintain usable land, to take some concern, to not destroy waterways, to not deplete forests, to not destroy soil quality. Because to do that was to compromise their own ruling position and their own wealth. Likewise, peasants, as the oppressed, labouring masses of the feudal era, you know, they were depended on the land as well for their... obviously, they had to give over some of their produce to the feudal lords and their rulers, but they depended, by and large, for their sustenance on the land as well. So they had a much more direct relationship to understanding how to maintain the world around them than what anyone experiences in capitalist society. And it's reflected, I guess, in the conception of nature that characterised previous forms of class society and capitalism. So, you know, in feudalism, there was the idea of nature as a proactive entity that, you know, it could be wrathful, it could be benevolent, but it was something that people had to contend with and could be a threat as well as a source of wealth and well-being for people, and that people had to find some way to, you know, fit in with this kind of force. Whereas in capitalism, the idea of nature is a dead commodity, something to be conquered, something passive, something that, you know, gives us things and asks us nothing in return. Because, you know, and that's the way capitalism, that is what capitalism's relationship to nature is. So unlike in feudalism, where wealth is a symbol, wealth is literally land, and capitalism, it's not that. You know, capital can be invested in land, but the idea is, you know, you might buy that, you make a profit out of it, that profit can be taken and anything can be done with it. You can buy factories, you can invest in any other kind of aspect of wealth generation. And so there, that breaks down the idea that the people with power in society have any concern or incentive to maintain any, you know, the health and well-being of the planet. And this is a major problem. The second aspect of what makes capitalism different from feudalism is, as I said, the labouring classes lose their connection with the land as well. That there's a much higher degree of alienation from the world around us for working class people than peasants. Like, and you know, peasants could do things to affect the natural world around them. They had some degree of control over that. They had a huge amount of knowledge about how to manage land and animals and trees and various ecosystems they find themselves confronted with. We lose all of that knowledge, and we have even less control as working class people in a capitalist society where, you know, we have, there's no sense in which we have ownership over means of maintaining our existence. So, you know, the work that we do is not on our own on our own land or anything that we ourselves own or control. It's, you know, selling our labour to someone else who does. And as I just outlined, the people that are buying that labour and using that capital have no incentive in maintaining any sort of protecting the environment. And the labouring masses, the working class, has even less ability to have any effect on the natural world because they're really deprived of any connection with it and obviously any political power over how capital is used. And then the third problem, I guess, that capitalism has as opposed to feudalism is the imperative towards growth that characterises the capitalist system. You know, that was limited in a feudal society, but capitalism is obviously a system of such intense competition that, you know, capital is meaningless if it's not always growing, being reinvested and expanding. And that, you know, is why in such a, you know, capitalism is such a rapidly developing society in such a short amount of time, so much damage has been done to the environment as a result of this system. And so if we take all that into account, I think it makes it much more clear why, you know, obviously the capitalist system has to go if we're to have any hope of maintaining a livable planet, but I think also why green capitalism is doomed to fail, because on the one hand, the apologists for the system argue that the climate crisis has created a whole incentive for the capitalist class to develop alternatives to some of the most destructive technologies of society. But the problem with that is that it's not an incentive to save the planet. It's that the climate crisis has created a new realm of profit-making for the capitalist class in the form of green capitalism. So the object of the exercise is to extract profit from the climate crisis by developing alternative technologies that can be seen as a green alternative to fossil fuels and whatnot. When in fact, but you know, because the same logic applies of no ongoing connection, no taking responsibility for the consequences, environmental or human, of the industries that, you know, capitalism makes no requirement for the capitalist class to be concerned about, you know, what might happen as a result of their activities, unlike in previous societies. And so, you know, this logic means that, you know, on a big enough scale, green technology is going to come up against a lot of the same problems. So that is a major problem. Secondly, I mean, even if at a sort of theoretical level, green capitalism could work, green capitalism, you know, has been tried and it's failed. There's been years and years now of negotiations, I'm sure people are well aware, that, that no one's under any illusions that climate change is not a major threat to the planet, and there's been ample time for, you know, these alternative technologies to develop and alternative industries, And they simply haven't, because, you know, the ideology of capitalism is just this free market, there's a demand for something, it will be filled, and, you know, capitalism will adjust to it, is not, as we know, the reality of the system, that all the vested interests, you know, fight to maintain their source of profits against potential competitors, and, you know, the power of the fossil fuel industries and all the, you know, it's not just energy generation, all the other industries that are tied up with that, either directly dependent on it or indirectly, you know, have no interest in trying to reorganise the world economy on a more sustainable, even if technically or in theory there was profits to be made potentially from this reorganisation. And, of course, the national divisions of capitalism and the imperialist competition that characterises it means no one country is going to take this risk to its, you know, standing, its prestige, its position in the world economy by doing this first. So capitalism is, I think, you know, structurally unable to make the adjustment that is needed. Finally, the question about the other thing I think that confirms the fact that economic growth or the imperative towards economic growth is one of the biggest problems with the capitalist system is that, you know, there's been an ongoing argument about, you know, can you reduce greenhouse gas emissions without while still having an economy that grows? Because, you know, I think Obama is the main person that's trying to push this, trying to convince the capitalist class is his approach that they should change, you know, restructure the economy in line with sustainability. Is that this doesn't have to cost profits, that this can be complementary with capitalism. And the big example that they point to is 2009, which is the one year where the emissions were reduced, but it was also the year that the world economy contracted the most as a result of the economic crisis, which I think really confirms the point that it's only when, and it wasn't like the world economy contracted in order to, reduce carbon emissions. It did it just because of their own stupidity, the debt crisis and whatever else. But, the fact that confirmed that only with the economy not contracting could you have a reduction in emissions made the point. Similarly, I think if you compare it to the last kind of existential crisis that humanity was facing, the mutually assured destruction of the Cold War, when the possibility of some nuclear event wiping out humanity felt very real to people in the 1980s. Again, it was not pleas on the part of people that, or a rational argument about the that it would be preferable not to die in a nuclear winter than to die in a nuclear winter. It wasn't those arguments that convinced the powers that be to abandon nuclear proliferation. In fact, it was a completely unrelated phenomenon, well, not completely unrelated phenomenon, but a apparently unrelated phenomenon of economic crisis in the Eastern Bloc that made the continued build-up of nuclear weapons an impossibility, gave rise to revolutions in 1989 that destroyed the regimes that were in competition with the West, that brought about, that made it impossible to continue. And I think that's sort of important point for us, because it can feel hopeless that, you know, the governments are just not reacting to people's concern about the environment. Like the fires in Brazil just so just blow your mind that people could be deliberately, and governments turning a blind eye to that sort of destruction, and it can seem like hopeless. And, you know, the idea that they're going to reorganise the economy targeting some of the most powerful industries on the planet can just seem like that's impossible. Like, we can't even get the government to raise New Start, you know, which is a tiny, tiny outlay of money for the poorest people in society. How on earth do we get them to stand up to the fossil fuel industries? But I think the fact that, the capitalist economy can be vulnerable, that, you know, for the people that, you know, wanted to end the build-up of nuclear weapons in the 1980s, actually the fact that finding any vulnerability in the capitalist economy that can start to undermine their power, that can start to, you know, bring people together to question the system from whatever, you know, even if environmentalism is not the thing that you know, it's not the only kind of avenue, that trying to exploit every weakness of the capitalist economy, and they're continually coming up, and, you know, economic crisis is an inevitable part of the system. All of that is also part of fighting for a future that is sustainable, because, bringing their power to their knees also means inhibits their ability to continue to destroy the world. Are you timing me, Alika? And I guess that brings us to the point about, you know, what Marxism has to offer people that are concerned about environmental destruction, because I think understanding that, you know, the unique features of the capitalist economy that make it uniquely destructive is important for seeing that. It's not just a matter of, you know, one or two industries that need to be curtailed. It's not just, you know, changing environmental policy won't be enough. But, you know, also that Marxism is a revolutionary theory that offers a theory for change as well, which I think is very important. And obviously, as hopefully people in this room understand, like, Marxism takes the struggle of the working class as the key to the key source of power that can challenge capital and ultimately not only destroy its power but create an alternative in its place based on collective democratic control of society's resources. And in such a society, you know, that's I think the only way to restore the balance between or create some sense of responsibility, a collective responsibility on the part of human beings to the world that we live in, and some sort of sustainable future. But, like, it's not the case that unions and the workers' movement is perceived to have always been at the forefront of environmental struggles, although they, you know, the unions and workers have much more than any other force in society. But there's, you know, they're also regularly mobilised by the right as a in the opposite direction, that and wedged on the basis of, you know, jobs or class collaborationist attitude to this is our, you know, you need to support your industry, or, you know, your living standards are going to take a hit, or you know, you need to be worried about the environmental refugees coming to get you. That's why we need to, you know, protect ourselves, and not, you know, the climate crisis is a threat to you that you need to side with your government against, you know, the potential threats it's going to create, rather than that it's a threat to our very existence. So the kind of class consciousness can be mobilised by the right wing and the ruling class to try and head off any challenge to it on an environmental basis. And, you know, that's a huge fight that needs to be had, and I think an argument for a stronger left, a stronger socialist movement that can counter those arguments, that can play a role in trying to rebuild a strong working class movement that can rediscover some of those traditions from the past of, you know, workers taking a stand. In Australia, like, well, you know, it's not been... not to exaggerate it, but the Australian working class movement has had some important, has been at the forefront of some important environmental victories. So the first ever industrial action in the world around the issue of nuclear was in Australia, when train workers refused to transport uranium to ports. The union movements pressured the Labor Party in Australia to curtail uranium mines under much protestation. There's been the campaign to save the Franklin Dam that unions were active in, as well as the green bans in Sydney that saved and Sydney and Melbourne that saved a whole lot of important landmarks and natural things. A lot of that history is forgotten. In the in the Lord Mayor election in Melbourne a few years ago, the mayoral debate was broadcast from the Victoria Markets in Melbourne, which is a site that was saved by union bands in the 60s or 70s, whenever they want to knock down the markets, on the basis not just of, you know, this is a nice heritage building, but also that this was a significant site for Aboriginal people, that, you know, the union movement took those questions seriously. And every mayoral candidate from, you know, the Liberal Party to whoever's saying, I love the Victoria Market, it's such a, you know, it's a wonderful Melbourne icon, blah, 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 without anyone acknowledging that, you know, this was only exists because the union movement was much stronger in the past and could defend some of the things that makes society, you know, bearable. And in fact, the one candidate who, you know, who's an anarchist who always runs in the Melbourne mayoral election, Albert Toscano, was one of the mayoral candidates being interviewed, and you know, he was saying, "Oh, we need to rebuild strike action. We need, you know, more." And he was laughed at by all, you know, John Fain and the ABC presenter and all the other candidates. As, "Oh, what a joke! This guy's a joke." Meanwhile, they're all sitting there saying how wonderful the Victoria Markets is, which only exists because our workers fought for it, and it's, you know, absolutely, of course, not a joke that we need to rebuild that sort of strength, and that's really the only hope, because there is no other force that has an incentive to save the environment or the power to do it. And it's absolutely fabulous that Extinction Rebellion is a movement that rejects all the hopeless dead end of trying to negotiate better environmental policy through the UN and God knows what other useless body, that sees that mobilising the people who stand to suffer as a result of the environmental crisis in a mass movement that's prepared to be disruptive, that challenges people, that doesn't try and appeal to the logic of the system, is an extremely important development. But it doesn't. It needs to be rooted in some sort of social power that, you know, when the stakes are raised and, you know, if the movement goes forward and there's greater confrontation with the powers that be, that has some source of strength that it can draw on that can counter that threat from the ruling class, because they will fight our side. A lot of people are worried about, I think Jeff Sparrow wrote an article about this, like the threat of eco-fascism, that people, you know, these environmentalists who are so rabid that they just reject democracy and think that society just has to be forced somehow or other through some authoritarian regime to reorganise itself to meet the climate crisis, which, I mean, if you think about it, is that really that stupid, given it's, if you're facing that or the extinction of the species, it's, given we already have authoritarian governments all around, what's the difference? But also, I think that's not the major threat that we're facing. The threat is the garden variety authoritarianism that we're already used to, of the governments that have a vested interest in the way the capitalist economy functions now and will fight to preserve it, just as they've fought to not have to take account of any, you know, emissions reductions goals, and, you know, just treat that kind of process with absolute contempt. And so they will be the authoritarian threat, I think, to any movement. And to answer that, it's not going to be enough just to block intersections and have, you know, discrete individuals coming together with a common concern, although that's obviously very important. We're going to need some force that can bring them to heel, that can, you know, disrupt the very practical efforts to repress people, but also can start to create such a crisis in the economy that their whole, the legitimacy of their rule is brought into question, and, you know, our side is forced to come together to better get a better idea of our power and meet the challenge posed by the climate crisis, ultimately in some sort of revolutionary movement that, you know, the working class is in the leadership of. That's obviously a long way away, but I think that strategic vision is the only source of hope that we have, and every little step that that has to happen between here and there is, you know, the way we have to think about it, rather than you know, rather than the kind of hopelessness that you could easily get to, you know, like maybe we won't be able to have a workers' revolution in time, but we need to fight for it, and we will need still political, you know, even in the event that the climate crisis is much worse than anyone predicts, we're still going to need political force to prevent it absolutely destroying our species and to salvage anything. So on that extremely depressing note, let's hope that we can build a strong enough movement on our side to prevent that eventuality. Well, thank you for a wonderful discussion. I think the point of this session and the other ones about the environment is that the solving the environmental crisis is shaping up to be the major sort of political question for, you know, in the foreseeable future. And on the one hand, there's this very welcome sense that there needs to be radical solutions, and people represented most clearly in the Extinction Rebellion are happy to do anything, like whatever it takes to the scale of the crisis demands sort of extreme action of various sorts. But this politicisation is coming in the context of many, many years of passivity, a very low level of class struggle, very little kind of understanding of pre-existing conception of how social change comes about, very little memory of or experience of the role that working class people can play in social change, and actually no real memory of any victories for our side in a very long time. And that's quite an explosive kind of situation. But it can also mean that you scratch the surface, you know, people have this radical intent, but it's very hard to break past what just seems common sense to changing things. So, you know, people often just, well, we need a better prime minister. It's like most often the kind of, and quite naturally, the thing that, you know, we need to find a way to make the people in power listen, or this or that. And so I think that it's really incumbent on us to be in a position to make a compelling case to these people in the, like, window, however long it might be, that we have it, to try and rebuild some sense of, or some depth to a radical movement that sees, you know, has a clear goal of an understanding of why the system is a problem and what we can do to combat it. And, you know, in some ways we're starting a bit from behind, because the environmental movement has been pretty conservative and, like, contemptible for a long time, focused on, you know, negotiations and whatnot. But that's changing, and we really need to keep up with it, I think. And like when there's any sort of political ferment goes on, it's funny how just basic philosophical questions come to the fore again. And people read Andre Malm's latest book, it's entirely a philosophical thing, trying coming to terms with how do we understand the or transcend the dichotomy between human society and nature. And he takes on all these various other theorists, people who argue that everything in the natural world has agency, coal has agency, therefore, you know, humans are no more responsible than any other part of the natural world, or the people who say, well, you can't make it, you know, maintaining Cartesian dichotomy to talk about the separation between human society and the natural world. So all these, like, what are, you know, really fairly abstract philosophical questions, like every time there's, you know, big political crisis come to the fore again, like came to the fore in World War One, like you had to go back to the basics of, you know, what is a dialectical materialist approach to understanding the problems that confront us? What is it that crucially about capitalism that, you know, makes it you know, uniquely destructive, and, you know, what's the thing you need to understand about the world we're in to arm yourself with the effective weapons to resolve the crisis that we're facing? And so, yeah, like insofar as this conference is a contribution to that, it's really important. But every aspect, I think, of Marxist theory ties into that, as people drew out, that you need a theory of imperialism, you need to understand the role of nation states, you need to understand how the political class operates, and just as much as you need to understand the relationship between nature and human society. So, yeah, thanks for the discussion.
Cool. Thank you.